Welcome to Resounds, Arts and Culture on the High Plains. I'm Corby Skinner.
And I'm Anna Page. And we're sharing stories of creative people who live and work in the Intermountain West. Kathy and Peter Halstead have known each other since they were 16. They were later classmates at both Columbia and NYU.
The couple share a deep passion for art and culture. Kathy is an abstract painter. Peter is a poet, pianist, and photographer.
But it is their philanthropic vision that brought the Halsteads to Fishtail, Montana to establish Tippett Rise Art Center.
Set on a 10,000-acre working sheep and cattle ranch, Tippett Rise hosts classical music concerts and exhibits large-scale outdoor sculptures.
Tippett Rise celebrates the concept that art, music, architecture, and nature are intimately linked in the human experience.
We are so honored today to have Peter and Kathy Halstead in the studio with us. Welcome to Billings.
Well, thank you.
For people that don't know, Peter and Kathy have developed, established, and are running one of the most fantastic music and art centers, not in Montana, but really in the country. Tippett Rise Art Center. And so we'd like to talk to them, just give a little bit of an overview about how it even came about. There were so many rumors about Tippett Rise before it actually opened its doors. So maybe we could start there. What was
the rumors were true. It's what we're actually doing is just a front for alien landings.
Yeah,
I think that was one of the rumors.
There were some people that were wondering if it was some sort of communist plot.
Those sculptures certainly look alien-like if they came from another world.
Well, they attract some of the better citizenry from some of the new planets we've discovered. Yes. They feel right at home. You know.
When the project started, you know, in terms of when you first thought about it, and really, what was the inspiration for Tippett Rise?
Well, I have to say there were so many inspirations, and really, it's something that we have been thinking about for decades, really since, I think, maybe even before we were married, but certainly, as you know, as we had our life together, thinking about all the absolutely amazing experiences we had going to Storm King Art Center back in New York State, I would say, you know, probably about 30 years ago, something maybe even 35 years ago, and just being in this gorgeous, beautiful green countryside with this amazing art. And in that particular case, we were just about the only people there. It was a beautiful summer day, and it really was life-changing for us. And thinking about so many other absolutely beautiful experiences that other people created so that, you know, we became the beneficiaries, and the idea that we could someday create something that would give other people who we didn't even know that experience to go, you know, out into the world and have that inside them, I think was, you know, very moving and absolutely, you know, started to create this passion in both of us.
Well, I think we've known each other since we were 16, so that's a long time ago. And we would always talk about this.
That's about 30 years, is that?
That's right.
Maybe less.
16 years ago. we would always talk about ideas. It's like, when I am queen, you know, like Lucy would say in Peanuts, we'd have these various fantasies of what we would do with things. And I have to say, when I went to Columbia in New York for college, and then I briefly went to NYU Film School, which was before they really taught filmmaking at film school. They taught things like how to remove your socks and smell your feet. That was called perception, and you got credit for it. And one of my – so it was – pre-film, but it prepared you for film theoretically. So one of the projects they gave me was go to the sculptures that are around New York City and sit down and experience those sculptures. And I remember I went to Astor Place, which had a wonderful sculpture called The Cube, and it's still there. And people write graffiti on it. You can move it physically by pushing it. People would have weddings there and parties there, raves, whatever you call it. And I just spent an entire day with it, and I sat there and I said, you know, what do I feel about this? What is the cube to me? What am I to the cube? And had this amazing spiritual experience writing it down, too. I wrote it down, how I related to this particular sculpture in the middle of New York City with cars buzzing around and millions of people there. And it really changed my life. I think the fact that I could relate personally to this inanimate object, and it really was a great interactive experience that changed my life. And I said, you know, to myself and later to Kathy, that I want to recreate that for other people. I want other people to have the experience. I want them. And this is the thing, when people come to Tibbet Rise, they take the van tours around to see our sculptures. But ideally, what I really would like them to do would be to get out of the van and let it drive off and then stay there by yourself and have a personal experience with a sculpture for 3 or 4 hours and then go back to the bus stop and get on the next van and leave. But how, you know, interact, and you don't think you have anything to say to a sculpture or that has anything to say to you, but in fact, spend a little while there and think about it, and you'll start, I think, feeling all kinds of wonderful things that it inspires in you.
It's such a wonderful contrast, though, from the din and noise of New York City to the absolutely tranquilness of Tibbet Rise and the beautiful mountains and the meadows, the meadowlarks, the flowers.
Yeah, what a different scene. What attracted you to bring this kind of sculptural experience to a landscape that Montana offers?
We fell in love with the West, and we moved, you know, not first to Montana, but to Colorado really almost 30 years ago. And the thought of, you know, going back to New York City, you know, which we have reasons to do, and we do, but really we so fell in love with the mountains and all that incredible open space. And as we realized that Tibbet Rise could take that step from the dream to the reality, we came up to Montana after, you know, really thinking about a lot of other places and looking, and certainly in Colorado, but then Montana, just the land, I think, you know, speaks to both of us in a way that is so enormous and yet so personal and so visceral in so many ways and so dramatic and primitive and gorgeous. Peter came up first and really, you know, spent, you know, a couple of weeks essentially looking at every corner of Montana where he thought Tibbet Rise might be possible. And when he got to Fishtail, he called me and said, I think you better come up. I think I found it. And when I got there, I really could almost feel trembling in every cell in my body. And that's why Montana.
Well, we spend a lot of time in Nantucket when we were younger, when our kids were younger, every summer. And the smell of the heather on the moors was, I have to say, gave us a sense of identity, a sense of being home. And we found that same smell from the sage and from the hay in Montana, in the fields of Montana. When we were at Storm King, in the beginning, there were very few sculptures there. So you could go to a meadow and there'd be nothing but one Mark de Souvre. And they actually, it was a flat farm, and they took bulldozers and they made it into rolling hills by man. It wasn't nature, actually, at Storm King. It was a flat farm that they turned rolling. And so they made a hill for a Noguchi sculpture and put the Noguchi on top of the hill. And so they made the land agree with the sculpture. And we said, well, why don't we make sculptures agree with the land? We'll get the land. Back in the old days, there was only one sculpture and you related to it and there was nothing else around to distract you. We said, what if we return to that idea at the beginning of Storm King and we have one valley and there's only one sculpture in there and that's all. And so everything around is all pointing towards that sculpture. And it's amazing how when you go to something like Proverb by Mark de Souvre, which is in Box Canyon, it changes the canyon. It changes the way
Absolutely.
The canyon feels. Yep. Feels, and then the canyon changes the way Proverb feels. They both have their an amazing interaction.
really the land is, you know, as inspiring or more inspiring as the art. And it's that, you know, power of the landscape is just so absolutely magnificent. And then to somehow have, you know, that possibility of encountering art, encountering music in that incredible landscape, I think everybody feels it. And I think people who, you know, have lived here forever, they know that landscape and have felt it their whole lives. But I think the people who come to it for the first time feel it mm-hmm. so deeply.
I know, I have a degree in sculpture, and in my mind, I couldn't see how it was going to work together, monumental sculpture and those rolling hills. So anybody that has been to Tippett Rise knows it's experiential. You see the landscape differently by having that sculpture there. And there's an interesting sort of appreciation of both of them that I don't think you would have with either one independent of each other. So,
well, and that the sculptures are interactive too, like you're saying, Peter, that you are there to interact with the art just as much as it is there to interact with the landscape and vice versa. So.
And they interact with each other. For instance, our Spanish architects made three different sculptures, and they were placed on the land as if the land, they took a constellation and they brought the stars down from the constellation, and then the points where the stars were, which were, let's say, they reduced a constellation, which obviously is, you know, billions of miles apart in, where the stars are, and they brought the stars down and made the stars like half a mile apart, say. So they implanted that constellation on the Earth. They brought the sky down to Earth. Then they put the sculptures where the stars were so that they would be naturally sighted, and they would sort of resonate in a way that was like the music of the spheres, the I think the frequencies of spin and orbits in the solar system, in the galaxy, create an equilibrium that's sonic, but at the same time, gravity proceeds from that. Gravity is entwined with those frequencies that they create. When you spin a top, there's a humming that you hear. And that frequency at the top, in the case of the planets, keeps the planets in harmony with the other planets. When they lose their spin and they start to slow down, and their spin goes like, like that, they fall out of orbit. They become meteorites, asteroids. They come down to Earth or down to Mars, and they have lost their divinity. They've lost their celestial nature. And so I think by bringing the sky down to the Earth and by basically embodying, trying to address the concept of celestial spin and celestial orbits and celestial frequencies in the music as well as the sculpture, we're trying to create a kind of music of the spheres, a kind of a experience that resonates with you and you're not sure why. But part of it is that, like Stonehenge, when you go to Stonehenge, you feel a kind of mysticism there. Right.
And a connection with the other.
Yes, yes. With the sky, with the, for instance, and I think there are a lot of sculptures that various people have done where they make a cave and then the light comes through only on Easter Sunday or only at the solstice. And it's a kind of primitive thing, which people know that that's what happened with Stonehenge, and that's what happened in the old days. They were meant to be celestial, sidereal. They were meant to be monuments that almost like observatory which observes the stars. They were meant to interact with the stars in a way that was very, you could say, superstitious, supernatural, mystical, druidical. You could say it's silly, of course, but at the same time, there is a strange power to these kinds of new ways of involving ourselves with the world, because when you think about it, we're influenced by things that we can see, but then they're influenced by things that we can't see, and then those things are influenced at the same time by things that no one can see. So we're really the invisible gears that shape our lives, our minds, our the luck that happens are things way beyond what we can see. When you hear a note of music, there are millions of sounds above and below those notes that we can only hear because our ears are limited. The overtones and the undertones exist there. And so we're hearing just the middle of it. When our eyes can only see a few colors, and we know there are millions of colors out there. And so you want to expand the ability to see and to hear by any means possible, whether you use a better kind of microphone, a better kind of a control board, you know, the newer systems of recording, say 4K or 8K in you know, video, you have provided a greater gamut, a greater experience to people without their understanding what the science might be behind it.
Well, you know, Peter, it makes me really curious how you decided on the particular sculptors for Tippett Rise.
That's a very good question because, in fact, we, after we saw the land and we imagined the potential for it, only then did we think who would fit in with this. And we realized there were hundreds of very well-known sculptors who would not. And we couldn't just go out and buy things, works of art, and put them in a field. And in fact, we had one architect, wonderful architect, world famous, who drew a whole lot of sculptures in a field and then made the building that they were hoping we would build, which we didn't. And when I saw all those little typical type of Jean Arp type sculptures all over the place, I said, good Lord, that's horrible. That's not what we mean at all. That would look terrible. That would be
and
so funny.
We're not going to mention that architect's name, are we?
No, we will not.
Or even Jean Arp.
Yes. No. So, although he is dead, so I don't think he'll mind. But
no, he does.
You know,
anyway.
He minds anyhow. It's all mystical.
Celestial
Jean Arp will mind, yes.
About the sculptures, not only the fact that you chose those for the land, which I love, but when you're there, you see clouds differently. When it's dark at Tippett Rise, you see more stars than you see anywhere. I think of coming out of a concert, and I looked up, and it was huge red sky, and I thought, that's what Scriabin meant. I mean,
yes.
I had heard this powerful music, and then you come out of the building and see something in an entirely new way.
The Mysterium, he believed in having a concert that would create a whole new vision of the world after it, if anyone survived the concert. His idea was there'd be, at the end of the concert, we'd be apocalypse, and there'd be lots of drinking and so on. But we didn't do all of that, but I think at the end of some of these concerts, you do see the world in a very different way.
Well, and the sky is so astonishing, and the clouds are so astonishing, and I think the way the sky interacts sometimes with some of the sculptures is absolutely surprising. And we were out on the land one evening after just that beautiful piece by Marc de Souvereau, Beethoven's Quartet, had just been installed. And we were having a gorgeous small concert of a beautiful
one of the Beethoven quartets.
Yes. And Mark was there, and the sky started to turn black. And we all ran into our cars. And of course, the musicians with their violins, especially, had to get in their cars. And then that passed, and everybody came out, and the sky turned purple, and Mark's gorgeous Beethoven's Quartet turned purple, and the musicians played, and it became darker and darker, and Mark cried, everyone cried. I mean, it was just an experience that in no way could you even imagine you could reproduce. It just happened, and because of the land, because of the mountains, because of that incredible, intense weather that happens at Tippett Rise, it can happen there.
Well, and to give our viewers an idea of what this sculpture looks like, it is almost bird-like in its shape and how it flows in the air, but yet you can take a mallet and play it. It's metallic, and it sends off these gorgeous reverberations depending on where you're at underneath it, and it's enormous. You can't believe the scale until you're right up next to it. And so it makes me curious about this concept of music outdoors. Tell me a little bit about how music changes when you bring it into the outdoors.
Well, let me also just add one more thing about that amazing sunset, that the sky itself was like, it was like being inside a rainbow. The moisture that was in the air that creates rainbows, of course, was purple itself, so that every drop of moisture surrounding you was purple. So it was like being inside a flower. It was like being inside a smoothie, in a way. It wasn't just that you were seeing purple far off or seeing a rainbow far off. It was like it was all around you. It was like you could touch it and it would like glisten. It was very extraordinary. It reminds me of Cézanne when you go to the south of France and you go to Saint-Rémy-de-Provence or the places where Cézanne painted Aix-en-Provence. You see these mountains, the Alpilles, there. And when you see them in the flesh, you say, ah, I've seen them before because Cézanne painted them. And you see a Cézanne. You don't see those mountains. You see it the way he saw, which is much richer and many more colors and much more fractal, much more cubist. And the same thing, and I wrote an essay on Isabel Johnson in the same way because she studied Cézanne when she was an art student, and she decided to bring Cézanne to the Sweetwater County, Stillwater County, to Carbon County, to the area where she lived. And so she painted, she brought to the simple ranch landscapes, which you would see there, she brought a kind of Cézanne, she brought a depth, she brought more, she brought the Riviera right. to Fishtail.
So some people may not know, but part of Tippett Rise is on the ranch once owned by the beloved Montana artist and educator Isabel Johnson, who taught for a time at MSU Billings when it was Eastern Montana College. So, and I loved Isabel Johnson, and people in our listening audience certainly are familiar with her work. So do you sense her spirit on the land there?
Very much so. We spent a lot of time around her studio, which she had on another ranch very near Tippett Rise, where she painted. And, of course, we met many, many dozens of people who had grown up, studied under her, and knew her, as you did. And wonderful, wonderful people from the area who are our friends, who could tell us incredible stories about what an amazing person she was and how she saw the world. I mean, she saw the hardship of living in the very cold temperatures of the winter as just miracles of labyrinths of lace and rime and ice storms and blizzards. And she transfigured the landscape with her painting so that you don't see the Montana winter the same way anymore.
A lot of people know about the sculptures and the concerts are going there, but you have an incredible education program going on with a number of universities, with the rural schools in the area. Can you talk a little bit about those programs?
Oh, absolutely. And I think, you know, one of the wonderful programs we've been able to, you know, host a little bit of Tippett Rise is with the Honors College at MSU in Bozeman and the, you know, incredible
Ilse Lee.
Yes, who's just such an amazing human being and has such wonderful students and has brought them, is bringing them back again this year, and was able to bring them for a whole weekend last year and is going to do that again. And I think it so informs us at Tippett Rise to really be able to see and talk to and hear the reactions of these wonderful young people who have such, I think true reactions to the sculpture, to the land, to be in that gorgeous, gorgeous corner of Montana and hear music and spend time talking about what art and sculpture and music and land mean to all of them.
When we brought Patrick Daugherty, he bends sticks to make villages and buildings out of bent willows and saplings, and he created his own we decided we wanted something that would last longer than many of his sculptures do because they're outside and they disintegrate after 3 years. So we built the replica of an old schoolhouse, which is about 10 miles away from the ranch, which is still there, where people go to meetings, and it's in the middle of nowhere. It's on the crest of a field, and it's a beautiful, beautiful old building. And so we replicated that to the wood and the 5 layers of paint and the nails sticking up where the shingles had disappeared from the roof, and he put his sculpture in there and around it as if it had grown around the building like weeds. And then we brought kids to come and talk with him and learn how to make their own Patrick Dohertys with Patrick Doherty. And they went back to their towns and they started making little Patrick Dohertys all around the area so that each town had for a while a little Patrick Doherty sculpture.
And do you remember Stephen Telesnik's piece too?
Yes.
Students were there and they totally got Stephen Telesnik's work. And all of a sudden, they were making forks and popsicle sculptures.
Oh, absolutely.
That were so fabulous with that same kind of orbital energy that is in his sculpture.
Well, Stephen talks about when he was a kid, he entered a contest to, what can you do with our brand with popsicle sticks? And so he made a roller coaster out of popsicle sticks. And ever since then, he's been making roller coasters. And they've gotten bigger and bigger. And now I think his sculpture is really a roller coaster disguised as the same shape as the satellite Pioneer, which was launched to see the dark side of the moon in 1973. Right there that you can see.
So you've got sculptural tours, you've got educational programs, you've got music going on. And in addition to that, too, you also have an architectural film feature coming up in September. Where did that idea come from?
Well, actually from the wonderful Stephen Telesnik, who has known the creator.
Kyle Bergman.
Thank you, Kyle Bergman, of the Architectural Film Festival for some time. And one of our wonderful young filmmakers last summer, but really kind of working with Stephen for a number of years, created a gorgeous short film about Stephen Telesnik. And that film opened the Architectural and Design Film Festival in New York last summer. And it had a score by this wonderful young French pianist who had come to Tippett Rise just to visit and found himself composing because he was so moved by the landscape. And that became the score for this little movie. And the little movie won the honor of being the opening short for the film festival. And then Kyle asked us, would we like to host the film festival, which is also going to Berlin. It's going
all over the world, really.
And coming to Fishtail in September.
I want to tell our listening audience, if you're wildly intrigued by what we've been talking about, Tippett Rise also has probably one of the best websites ever. Not only are there fabulous photographs, but wonderful videos and audio recordings and films. So tippettrise.org is the website. And I would encourage people to get tickets to the film festival that will be in September.
Well, Peter, Kathy, thank you so much for being in the studios with us today. We really enjoyed our conversation.
Thank you, Anna. Thank you, Corby. It was fun for us, too.
Thank you so much.
Loved being here. Thank you.
You've been listening to Resounds, Arts and Culture on the High Plains, produced by Anna Page, Corby Skinner, and Ken Siebert for Yellowstone Public Radio. Theme music by Alex Naumann. Hear this program anytime online at ypradio.org.